I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last Friday, a New Jersey jury found former Rutgers University student Darun Ravi guilty of invasion of privacy, several counts of bias, intimidation, witness, and evidence tampering after spying on his roommate Tyler Clementi, who was in bed with a man he had invited to their room. Ravi secretly used a webcam two times and tweeted about his roommate's sexual encounter to his friends. Ravi was not charged in Clementi's death, who committed suicide by jumping off the George Washington Bridge. Ravi is scheduled to be sentenced in May and could face up to 10 years in prison and deportation. This tragic incident and the jury's verdict has raised important questions and issues related to hate crimes, cyber law, privacy, and something Ravi's lawyer said about his client, stupid kid behavior. So today in Radio Times, does the punishment fit the crime? And we are joined by two lawyers. Daniel Citron is a professor of law at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. Her scholarship focuses on information privacy law, cyber law, and civil rights. She's currently working on a book to be called Hate 3.0. And Danielle Citron, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Also with us is Suzanne Goldberg, a clinical professor of law at Columbia University, director of the university's Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. And Suzanne Goldberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here.
And Suzanne, if I could begin with you and begin broadly with this question, does the punishment of Darun Ravi, does the punishment fit the crime from your perspective?
Well, of course, we don't know what the punishment is yet because he hasn't been sentenced. And I think the kinds of concerns that have been raised about wanting to ensure that there's not a backlash if Ravi is oversentenced will probably be pressing on the judge's mind. So, again, without knowing the punishment, I think what we can say is that the prosecution did its job in this case. Its job was to prove that Ravi had either intended to intimidate Clementi because of his sexual orientation or that Clementi experienced what Ravi did as targeted at him because he was gay. And again, the jury came back clearly on those questions. And so in our system of criminal justice, the next step is the sentencing.
And so and that's a definition of bias intimidation?
Right. The bias intimidation has three components. One, it can be that the defendant acted with the purpose of intimidating. Second is that the defendant acted knowing that what he or she did would intimidate the victim, again, because of either, in this case, race, color, religion, gender, disability, sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, national origin or ethnicity. Those are all the aspects of identity covered by the statute. The third is the one where the prosecution focused in this case, which is that the defendant, Ravi, acted in a way that caused his victim to be intimidated and know that he was targeted because he was gay. And I think, again, when you look at the tweets, when you look at why Ravi was doing this, I think it doesn't leave a lot of question there.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Danielle Citron. And again, broadly speaking, but obviously there's a lot of nuance and detail in this particular case. But if Ravi is sentenced to 10 years in prison for what he did related to Tyler Clementi, does the punishment fit the crime?
So I think that's precisely the concern that Suzanne has identified, is that if he's sentenced to 10 years or something close to that, I think there'll be a powerful sense that it's just unfair, that because you hear so much that the evidence was mixed. So I'm with Suzanne that there's fairly clear evidence that Ravi knew that he was sort of publicly shaming Tyler for being gay and then sort of exposing his sexuality in a way that was incredibly demeaning. I think if it's close to 10 years and leads to his deportation, and even if it doesn't, I have a sense that you already are hearing calls that this kind of sentencing enhancement shouldn't be used for crimes that aren't involving violence. And I think that's a huge mistake, given the kind of bigoted harassment that we see online. And so I worry if the sentence is indeed close to 10 years, that what we'll have is calls to sort of change the hate crime laws or sentencing enhancements, so that we don't reach the kind of privacy invasions and harassment that we see that doesn't involve physical violence. And that would be really a turn, I think, backwards.
Well, Danielle, let me just pick up on what you just said. From your perspective, there's a difference between online or cyber harassment or even intimidation and physical harassment / intimidation?
Well, I think they can have the same really powerful effect on individuals. Often you see harassment both online and offline. Sometimes the harassment is exclusively online, but nonetheless, the impact that it has, what it says and does, is powerful. It's intimidating, it's silencing, it can ensure that people are terrorized, that they sort of can't date or can't work, so that we shouldn't say just because it's online, that it's words, that it's meaningless. It can have a powerful impact on people's lives. And so I would hate that this to be the test case that everyone points to and says, aha, this is where we're going too far, that because it's only words, it's online, it has no impact on people, and that then we turn sort of the corner and say, all right, now we're going to not pursue hate crime laws or sentencing enhancements when it's not physicalized violence or sort of direct face-to-face threats. So that's my concern.
Suzanne, let me go back to you, and actually something that Ravi's lawyer said, obviously in defense of his client, but he described his behavior as stupid kid behavior. We're talking about a freshman in college who behaved in many ways reprehensibly, but he raised questions about whether this was actually a crime that was committed, and I'm just curious about your response to that.
There is no immunity from criminal prosecution for people who act who violate criminal laws in college, and I think it was in a sense a smart strategy by the defense to say, look, college kids do a lot of stupid things. This was one. Don't punish it criminally. On the other hand, if you look at what actually happened in this case, Ravi did something that most people wouldn't do, which was to webcam his roommate having sex and to try to show that to others. And so I think for some people, they look at what happened and think, oh gosh, I did some dumb things in college, or maybe my kids will do some dumb things in college and I don't want them to face criminal punishment. But this, when you actually look at what happens, this goes very, very far over the line. I do think, though, to connect this issue to what we were just talking about, that if there is a very heavy sentence in this case, I think the backlash will be partly fueled by the concern about Ravi as a young man rather than the fact that this happened over the Internet. I think the two issues are getting conflated, and again, I think, this is tragic, and I think we would all like to think, and it's probably true, that had Ravi actually known what he was doing, or that right, he might cause Clementi to commit suicide, I think we'd all like to think he wouldn't have done that. But that doesn't immunize him, again, from criminal conviction here.
But he was not ever charged in
right,
Clementi's death. I mean, we should make that, I think that's an important distinction that we should make sure that people understand.
Yes, I think that is very important. He wasn't charged with Clementi's death. Clementi's death wasn't part of the sort of literal conversation at the trial. It wasn't. It was kept out of, the formal proceedings. Still, as every report I have read has said, it hung over the trial. Everybody
sure
knows what happened. But the prosecution was very, very careful, and I'm sure the judge was monitoring this as well, was very careful to make sure to say this isn't, this is about the question, did Ravi invade his roommate's privacy, and did he do it because he was gay and intended to, or was this experienced by his roommate as bias intimidation?
You know what, Suzanne, we're going to call you back because I apologize. We're just having a lot of distortion with our phone lines. We're going to see if we can get you on a better line. So we will say goodbye to you and hopefully say hello to you in just a couple of minutes. Danielle Citrin, let me turn to you. And this gets into some of the details of the case. But Ravi, two times, used this webcam to spy on his roommate. The first time was when his roommate invited a strange man into their room that they shared together. If he had just done this once, and according to what we know about Ravi or what has been said in his for him was that he was concerned that there was a stranger in their room, and he didn't know, you know, what this stranger might be up to. If he had just done that and not tweeted about it or not done it a second time, would we be having this conversation?
You know, maybe we wouldn't be, right? So I think and it sounds like some of the reports from jurors who've spoken to the press, is that the second attempt, even though it was foiled by Tyler Clemente, but the attempt to sort of publicly shame him, calling on people to come watch, and then tweeting a friend of his to say gays should all go away, I think that convinced the jury that it was really knowing that he engaged in a privacy intruding on his seclusion and his really private, you know, sexual relationship in ways that were intended because he was gay and to shame him. I think that's right. I also think that we might not be having this conversation if Tyler Clemente hadn't committed suicide. Because, you know, so many people have said, look, it's such a borderline case that, at least in respect to, there's conflicting evidence and there are a lot of complexities about what would happen, that perhaps we would have a conversation about criminal privacy invasion, but if he hadn't committed suicide, that we might not even be here at all. I'm not sure if I agree with that we shouldn't be here, but that's often what you hear.
Well, and in cases like this, but obviously there's a lot of email traffic back and forth, and this is on the 21st of September 2010. Tyler tells his resident advisor he wants a different room. He says, I feel that my privacy has been violated. I'm extremely uncomfortable sharing a room with someone who would act in this wildly inappropriate manner after finding out that he had been basically spied upon. And then a couple of hours later, Ravi sends a text to Clemente saying, I've known that you were gay. I have no problem with it. In fact, one of my closest friends is gay, and he and I have a very open relationship. I'm sorry if you heard something distorted and disturbing. I want to assure you that all my actions were good-natured. How do you understand what Ravi is saying to Clemente there?
I mean, I think it's regret, right? So, though Clemente never sees it, apparently, I think he had remorse for what he did. He sort of saw it. It sort of woke him up, the conversation with the RA or getting notice that his roommate wanted to leave. In some sense, he was performing for his friends. So some of it, I have a powerful sense that bigotry is driving what he's doing. Insensitivity is driving it. And he's performing. He's being a big shot, right? That's the immature, that's the conversation people are having, is, oh, he's just kids being kids. He's being a jerk. We're convicting him for being a jerk. But I think he felt remorseful. So perhaps it's complex. That is what motivated him. But nonetheless, what he did demeaned his roommate and shamed him and essentially, made him feel terrible about himself and humiliated.
Well, tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about hate crime, cyber law, and the Rutgers University spy cam case. Talking with Danielle Citrin, professor of law at the University of Maryland, Francis Key Carey School of Law, and Suzanne Goldberg, clinical professor of law at Columbia University, director of the University Center for Gender and Sexuality Law, talking about the verdict last week, finding Darren Ravi guilty of invasion of privacy, several counts of bias, intimidation, witness and evidence tampering. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you make of this case? What do you make of this verdict? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Walk MS supports WHYY. Research shows that one out of two local residents know someone living with multiple sclerosis. That someone, your sister, coworker, or even that neighbor who insists on cheering for the Yankees, needs your help. Walk MS is changing the lives of the thousands of local someones affected by MS. More at 800-883-WALK or walkformS.org. That's walkformS.org for the Walk MS coming this spring in a community near you.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and I'm excited to announce that I'm coming to Princeton, New Jersey to give a talk about how we put together a radio show each week. I'll be playing clips and favorite stories, and I can basically mix the show on stage live as you watch. And unlike some other public radio hosts, I do not sing. It'll be Sunday, April 29th, 3 in the afternoon at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton. Proceeds benefit WHYY. For more information, visit whyy.org/member experience.
Peter Nero and the Philly Pops support WHYY and present Symphonic Surf and Safari now through March 25th at the Kimmel Center. Papa Do Run Run joins Peter and the Pops in a Beach Boys tribute that will transport audiences straight to sunny California. Peter Nero and the Philly Pops Symphonic Surf and Safari featuring Papa Do Run Run, now through March 25th. For tickets, 215-893-1999 or phillypops.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with two law professors, Daniel Citron and Suzanne Goldberg, about the case involving Darun Ravi, found guilty last week of a hate crime, invasion of privacy, evidence tampering. This case received national attention after Ravi, who was a Rutgers University student, spied on his roommate Tyler Clementi having sex with a man and then tweeted about it to his friends. Clementi sadly committed suicide by jumping off the George Washington Bridge. Ravi could face 10 years in prison and deportation, and this tragic case raising a whole host of questions about cyber law, bullying, bias, intimidation, and something that Ravi's lawyer called stupid kid behavior. We have a full bank of calls here. I do want to get to our callers, but Suzanne, hopefully we got you back on a better line. I am curious about when you look at New Jersey, and I know that different states have different ways of defining bias, intimidation. What exactly are we talking about as you look at New Jersey law?
But so we're talking about a law that tries to capture the full range of bias intimidation, meaning when the perpetrator, intended to intimidate the victim because of the victim's identity, and when the victim experienced what the perpetrator did as an intent to intimidate him or her because of the victim's identity. And the point, to go back to something Danielle was saying earlier, is that the nature of hate crimes is that they harm not only the targeted victim, but also a much broader community. And that's the case whether somebody is beaten up and dragged under a truck or left to die, or gravestones are painted with swastikas, or in a case like this, somebody's private intimacy is exposed and touted to others as "see my gay roommate." They're not entirely different things, as I think some people would like to paint them.
Well, and when we're talking about, I guess, this protected category of people, it's by race, gender, sexual orientation, disability, that sort of broad category, Suzanne?
Yeah, they're broad categories, and part of the point there, they're broad, sort of typical identity categories that are protected in anti-discrimination laws in New Jersey and elsewhere as well. And part of the point is that these aren't laws only to protect minority groups, right? They are laws that protect anybody. If somebody in a majority group is targeted because of this aspect of their identity, they too may be the victim of bias intimidation. It doesn't often happen that way, but the law allows for those kinds of prosecutions as well.
Daniel, let me read something that was in an article about this case, and something that the judge apparently said in an open courtroom, but apparently the jury had been excused. This is about the New Jersey statute, and the judge says, "I've read the statute and read the statute more times than I can count. I've studied it. The statute to me is muddled. If I had written it, I would have written it differently, but I didn't write it. The legislature did." We can't get into the details of this particular statute, but do you think there are problems sometimes applying a particular statute to a particular case?
Okay, so I get a sense from Suzanne. Suzanne did a great job explaining the sort of three subparts of the bias intimidation statute, and I'm so interested to hear what Suzanne thinks, because I just don't think it's as confusing or muddled as the judge suggests it is, though I'm only looking at one part of the New Jersey Code. It was one of the number of counts.
Right.
So the purpose to intimidate someone because of their race, religion, and, their sexual orientation, ethnicity, or knowing that the privacy invasion would cause the person to be intimidated because of their sexual orientation, or kind of sensing or realizing, reasonably knowing that what happened, the privacy invasion, would cause that person to feel intimidated, to me is fairly clear. So I recognize the judge has said that. I don't think that's the nub of the problem, though. I'm curious to hear what Suzanne thinks.
Me as well. Go ahead, Suzanne.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Danielle on this. I'd say two things. One, lots of statutes are muddled and difficult to apply, so I think that's in the norm of experience for judges. But this statute is clear. I suspect that what the judge was getting at is, these are hard issues. And it's a sad case all the way around. And it's complicated, right? Because, you know, there's not a sense that Ravi was doing sort of the worst of the worst of bias intimidation. But again, meaning what we think of traditionally as the worst of the worst, I'm taking you out and pummeling you because you're gay. And I think part of the point of this case and the lesson from it is that bias attacks, bias intimidation causes a lot of damage all the way around. And I think part of what the New Jersey legislature was recognizing is that even if the perpetrator says, oh, well, I wasn't really targeting him because he was being gay, he's gay, I was just being stupid, right? I was just being a stupid college freshman,
right.
Which, again, I don't think even most immature college freshmen do this sort of thing. The point is that it can cause harm, and criminal statutes don't only punish conduct when the perpetrator intends to cause the harm. We have a whole array of criminal laws that punish conduct because it does cause harm, because the person was negligent or thoughtless and should have taken better care not to do the things that they did.
Not to get too legalistic here, but again, in doing a lot of homework for the show, and I'll go back to you, Suzanne, but Danielle, I'd like to hear from you as well. But are there First Amendment issues at stake here? And I'm reading, again, this was a critique of the verdict saying the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution has been invoked to protect the rights of neo-Nazis to march in Jewish neighborhoods where Holocaust survivors live. Could there be any more insensitive act than that, the idea that people have the right to say horrible things in this country?
Yes, right. They do. This is a, I'll just jump in briefly.
Sure,
I mean,
go
this
ahead.
Is a classic debate about hate crimes laws.
Right.
You know, the question is, well, aren't we just punishing thought, you know, and expression of that thought? You know, isn't the United States all about protecting people's right to hold hideous ideas and to speak about them? And the general answer, I mean, there's still debate about this, but the answer that courts have come to is that, of course, you can say your nasty thoughts. What you can't do is engage in acts that cause harm.
So it's the behavior, not the thought or the
right,
speech.
Right. Nobody punishes Ravi for making fun even if he were to sort of have sort of worn anti-gay T-shirts or whatever. Nobody is punishing him for his thoughts, right? The punishment comes because he used his webcammed his roommate, exposed it to others because his roommate was gay, right? There's and I think again it becomes confusing to people because of course thoughts and expression and conduct are all along a spectrum, and I think as in many parts of the law, right? The lines are not neat, but nonetheless, even the Supreme Court has recognized that some forms of bias, intimidation are constitutional and are not forbidden, and the First Amendment's protections for free expression do not immunize hateful thoughts when they're translated into conduct.
Danielle, you want to add to that? And then I do want to get to our callers. We've got a lot of callers who want to join our conversation. Danielle, go ahead.
Yes, Suzanne's absolutely right. So the Supreme Court has recognized that we can have sentencing enhancements for hate crimes, and privacy invasion was one of the crimes included in that statute, because what we're punishing for the enhancement for the hate crime is the targeting of the person, the bias motive, coupled with the very special harm to individuals, groups, and society that results. And so the court has upheld sentence enhancements for hate crimes because what we're punishing is the bias motive coupled with, as Suzanne underscores, the very special, unique, and damaging harm to individuals, groups, and society.
And that's Danielle Citron, professor of law at the University of Maryland Francis Key Carey School of Law, working on a book to be titled Hate 3.0, to be published by Harvard University Press. Also with us is Suzanne Goldberg, clinical professor of law at Columbia University and director of the University's Center for Gender and Sexuality Law, talking about the verdict last week against Rutgers University student Darun Ravi, used a webcam to spy on his roommate Tyler Clementi, and he was found guilty of invasion of privacy, bias, intimidation, evidence, and witness tampering. Let me see what Suzanne from Lebanon has to say. And Suzanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm Susan Wheeler. My son, Jimmy Wheeler, committed suicide back in 1997. In fact, he became quite famous. They did a Quality Forum out of Philadelphia, did a documentary on him called mm-hmm. Jim is Bold. He had written a lot of poetry. And it was kind of like, well, back then he was a victim of a hate crime. Although there was nothing we could do about it, he unfortunately had been taken out of the shower and urinated on by his classmate. And had we known that at the time, we could have pressed charges and followed through a legal system and perhaps sent a message loud and clear that this is not acceptable, that all kinds of bullying and harassment, and whether they be teasing, whatever, you know, you were talking about you can't prosecute because of verbal insults, but the effect on those, on the person who's gay or whatever, are cumulative. And after a while, and I don't know Tyler, and my heart grieves for Tyler and his family, but I'm sure after a while you can only take so much. And then there's the straw that breaks the camel's back. And, you know, you feel like you're forced into something like what Tyler did and like what Jimmy did. So I think, and I'll come out very strongly about this because I've traveled the country saying, no bullying, no harassment, watch your language, words have consequences, actions have consequences, and there has to be some sort of muscle to the consequences.
Well,
and this is what's so very important about what your guests are talking about and what's happening to Robbie. We have to send a message loud and clear that we're not going to tolerate this anymore.
Well, Susan, I, first of all, as speaking for all of us here, thank you for calling in. And I'm obviously very sorry for what happened with your son, and I think you have some very important things to tell us. Let me give Suzanne Goldberg a chance to weigh in. Suzanne?
Yeah, I also am so sorry, and I think that one of the things that we have learned in, especially in the last 10 years and even since the time that your son committed suicide, is that, you know, the old adage about, you know, sticks and stones can break my bones but words will never hurt me is just not true. And in fact, with the increasing focus on bullying, understanding its roots, understanding the harm it causes, as a society, and especially including educators, we increasingly understand that actually words can cause great harm, sometimes more damage even than the physical harm. And that is a piece of what I think educators have a responsibility to address, and in fact, it's part of what even the United States Department of Education is trying to address through its anti-bullying campaign. Separate question, can somebody be prosecuted for saying anti-gay slurs? Under the New Jersey law, there has to be something more. There has to be an actual crime. Usually, in the ordinary circumstance, cursing at somebody, saying anti-gay epithets, for example, would not be criminal, although there are circumstances where the intimidation can rise to the level of causing a crime, of being criminalized.
Susan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Danielle, she talked about it's important to have consequences, but I hear from you and I believe from Suzanne as well, is that, you know, 10 years might be too long a sentence for Darwin Ravi. What do you think is the appropriate punishment / consequences for what he did? Danielle?
You know, folks have asked me that, and I struggle with an answer. I think that some jail time is inevitably appropriate. You know, he turned down a plea that was no jail time. And so I think it's going to be inevitable that he gets some jail time. I think the problem with a too low of a sentence, so you've got two problems, right? One is that if it's too harsh, people are going to sense it's unfair. And as Suzanne underscored it, there could be certainly a backlash or rejection of using these kinds of crimes or hate crime enhancement in other cases where it's very well merited. I think on the other hand, you've got the problem if the sentence is too light, then the message rings hollow, mm-hmm. right? So what what Jimmy's mom is doing is going out talking to people and conveying this powerful message that not only to people who might someday be perpetrators, but also to the bystanders, right? To do something, say something, contact the internet intermediary if it's online, or say something to a school official. Don't stand by. That is, we all have a responsibility to stop this before it gets even further, right? So I have concerns. That's why I struggle, I think, with coming up with any kind of recommended. I'm glad I'm not the judge, but, you know, I think coming up with a recommended sentence that would you don't want to trivialize it, right, what right. he did, because what he did was so wrong.
Well, let me get, looks like Phyllis from Princeton to join our conversation. And Phyllis, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
What's upsetting me about this whole conversation that's going on today on the radio is that you're focusing on the hate crime piece of it. And I have followed the Darren Robbie case in the paper every single day since it started. And this kid is not just being was not just being convicted of a hate crime. He also tried to cover up this crime. He changed emails. He changed tweets. This kid deserves to get some jail time. I am a liberal. I'm a liberal Democrat. But this kid was arrogant and nasty. And as you mentioned just a few minutes ago, he did turn down a plea bargain where he didn't have any jail time. This kid should get jail time because not only because he did a hate crime, but he tried to cover it up.
Well, you know what, Phyllis, we mentioned that, but we haven't spent a lot of time talking about the evidence and witness tampering. But let me give Suzanne Goldberg a chance to weigh in on that. How serious is that charge or that conviction?
I mean, it's quite serious. I think we can have the same debate about that as people are having about the bias intimidation aspect of the charges against him, which is, was he trying to cover up because he was deliberately trying to interfere with a criminal investigation, or was he trying to cover up because, you know, he didn't know better, right? And because he was trying to certainly cover his tracks, but because he didn't have the maturity to realize that he was actually doing something that was additionally criminal, right? Interfering with an investigation. You know, was it stupid or was it criminal? I mean, the reality is that many people who wind up being convicted of crimes are convicted of exactly this, are convicted of interfering with an investigation. To me, it's not surprising that he did that. I think it certainly does indicate that he realized he did something wrong and that he was trying to cover his tracks, whether it was as bad as a sort of corporate officer, you know, trying to alter emails is hard to say. I think here again, the 18-year-old piece of this, being an 18-year-old, comes into play. But also, again, I would say that most 18-year-olds in this situation, once they understood that they were at risk of being charged with a crime, would perhaps decide, even if they were inclined to try to cover their tracks in this way, wouldn't do it. And well, I think to that point, right, he stepped very, very far over the line. And I think that is part of what gets lost in this debate about youthfulness.
Well, we have to take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Phyllis, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about the guilty verdict last week. Darren Robbie found guilty of a hate crime, invasion of privacy, evidence and witness tampering. The case, of course, received national attention when it was learned that he spied on his roommate, a young man named Tyler Clementi, having sex with a man. He tweeted about it to his friends. Clementi sadly committed suicide by jumping off the George Washington Bridge. We're talking with law professors Daniel Citrin and Suzanne Goldberg. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Museum of American Jewish History supports WHYY and presents Mayim Bialik. Following a panel discussion about bat mitzvah and coming of age in America, Mayim, best known for her current role on The Big Bang Theory and the 90s sitcom Blossom, will share her coming of age experiences as a young Jewish woman on and off set, discuss her endeavors in the academic and entertainment worlds, and explore how her background influences her work. Sunday, March 25th at 2 p.m., nmajh.org or 215-923-3811.
Every day on Here and Now, we help you understand the news. And what does this mean for abortion clinics? What can or can't they do?
Well, abortion clinics still have protection under the...
And take some time to enjoy life.
The expression was never, hey, lady, ever. It was just, lady.
I'm Robin Young. Please join us Here and Now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The College of Graduate Studies at University of the Sciences supports WHYY and offers more than 20 master's, PhD, and certificate programs. Many of their advanced degree programs offer part-time, evening, and online options. University of the Sciences graduate students work alongside faculty who are leaders in fields like biological sciences, chemistry, and health psychology. To learn more, visit University of the Sciences online at gradschool.usciences.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone talking with lawyers Danielle Citrin and Suzanne Goldberg about the Rutgers University spy cam case, cyber law, hate crimes. And we have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Millicent from Bucks County to join us. And Millicent, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
My question is about the expectation of privacy. What exactly is the expectation of privacy in a college dorm room where you share a bedroom with somebody you are basically assigned to live with by the university? You have no choice in who you're living with. You share the bedroom. I don't know what the expectation of privacy is there. And also, what does it say about students, regardless of sexual orientation, bringing home partners that maybe aren't even in the university to have sex in their dorm rooms?
It's a fair question, and Daniel, let me toss that to you. And Tyler Clementi apparently met this man. I'm not sure if it was online or somewhere else, and brought him back to their room.
Right. So I'm going to tackle the first one. You know, is there an expectation of privacy in a shared room? Well, our expectations of privacy, of course, are tailored to the given circumstance. So Tyler was in a room with someone. The door was closed. He told his roommate he was going to be there. In that sense, that. It was a sort of a sacred private space for that time period. And so to have someone intrude on your seclusion in that way, in a room in which if the door is locked, you know you're the only ones in there, sexual activity is one of those things that we think are very sacred, that if there is an intrusion on our seclusion for something like our sexual activity, we consider we have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that space.
Well, let me just ask you something, though, because what we heard from Darren Ravi was, at least on this first incident, he didn't know who this man was, and he was concerned that he might steal something from him, for instance.
Right, and that's, you know, certainly the jury heard that at that test, you know, heard some, I think, testimony to that effect, though I know the defendant didn't take the stand. But they didn't buy it, right? Mm-hmm. If he was afraid that his iPad would be stolen, he could have taken it with him. So, you know, as you rightly say, look, there are other circumstances, and we take all of that, the jury took all of that into consideration, and, you know, given those circumstances that he gave him permission to use the room, that the door was closed, what they were doing was something we consider very private. You know, in the end, I think the jury was totally justified in finding an invasion of privacy.
Suzanne, I could just add one small point.
Yeah, go ahead, Suzanne.
Two points. One, put yourself in the situation, right? If you have a roommate and you're concerned that the roommate's guest might steal your things, what are your options? Talk to the roommate about it. If you don't want to talk to the roommate, talk to a resident advisor. If you don't want to talk to a resident advisor, but you feel the need to try to video webcam whatever the potential theft might be, where do you train your webcam? Mm. On your stuff, not on the roommate's bed.
Millicent, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Daniel, let me go back to you. And this is a speculative question, but if Darren Ravi's roommate was not gay, and Darren Ravi had done the same thing, which was to, you know, secretly videotape him having a sexual encounter with a stranger in their room or someone that he didn't know, would this have been a crime?
I mean, it depends on what he said. So, for example, I've had students tell me that, you know, at college there they had heard about stories of heterosexual couples where a roommate taped someone having sex because why? The woman was fat and ugly and they wanted to embarrass her. Mm. To me, that strikes as the very same thing as going on here. We're going to demean someone and shame them in very humiliating ways based on gender. And so in that circumstance where we see evidence of certainly demeaning treatment and shaming, I know I added some thoughts to your hypothetical, but I think, you know, that it's a heterosexual, a homosexual couple is of moment when we think about what's said and the behavior. So think it's significant? Sure, but it depends on the circumstances.
Let me get Will from Glenn Mills to join our conversation. And Glenn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I'm gay, and I have mixed feelings about the verdict, just because of the hate crime aspect. It's not clear that Ravi ever meant for Tyler to find out about this, so I don't understand how it could be intimidation or bias.
Even though he tweeted to some of his friends, this would be Darren Ravi, and there was some conversation back and forth about what was going on in the room?
Right, but it wasn't, it was never clear that it was meant to get back to Tyler about it. I don't know.
Even though Tyler learned about it?
Right.
It's a fair question. Let me see what Suzanne Goldberg has to say. Suzanne?
I guess a couple of responses. First, college students, even high school students, know that when you put something out in the public domain on the internet, whether through a tweet or anything else, it is available to everyone. And the idea that Ravi or anybody else somehow wouldn't realize that their postings aren't available and couldn't be accessed by a roommate is ridiculous, I think. But the second is we have to look at the law, right? And the law that the New Jersey legislature passed makes clear that if the victim was intimidated and by the defendant's actions because of the protected aspect of identity, because of sexual orientation, and if that is reasonable for the victim to have been intimidated, that's enough, right? So maybe Ravi wasn't emailing these things or texting them to Tyler Clementi, but he didn't have to do that to commit the crime of bias intimidation. And again, I think, you know, maybe those of us who are a little bit older don't experience the world quite as digitally as freshmen and as people who are freshmen in college. But I think we all know that you don't have to be the recipient of an email to see something about you online and be intimidated by it or have any other reaction.
Danielle, do you want to add to that, Danielle?
No, I think Suzanne has it right.
This is, may sound like a really stupid and very basic question here, and I'll toss this to you, Danielle Citrin, but we're talking obviously about, in this case, 18-year-olds, freshmen in college. Do you have to be as knowledgeable as a law professor in order to knowingly break the law, Danielle?
I mean, certainly no, right? I mean, so your question is, do you have to know all the interstices of the law to commit a crime? You have to be on notice that someone's, I mean, Suzanne, help me out here, but I think you certainly have to be on notice. The law should never be arcane so that we can't understand it in the public. But certainly, in passing these laws, we send a message to the public that you can't harass someone, you can't invade their privacy, you can't threaten them. And we could add some more crimes to the table, but I don't think you need to be a law professor, certainly, to understand that what he did was wrong.
I agree with Danielle on this, and I think take the average person on the street, the average young person, and ask them, do you think that it's allowable under the law to webcam your roommate having sex and post it to others? And they would say no. And I think this actually, though, links to a bigger issue about crimes on college campuses. There is, you know, epidemic sexual assault and sexual harassment. And so much of the time, this kind of conduct is swept under the rug and treated as even conduct that would be criminal if it is criminal and that would be dealt with through the criminal system if it took place off of a college campus is somehow, or their arguments that, oh, well, we think of it differently because, you know, college freshmen do stupid things. But that is of a piece with this. College freshmen have the freedom to do stupid things. What they don't have the freedom to do is break the law.
Let me see what looks like Andrea from Chestnut Hill has to say. And Andrea, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. That would be number three. Yes, go ahead, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was actually stalked when I was in my 20s. This is the 1980s. And I know how devastating it could be, just words. And this is, I guess, right before stalking laws. And the cops just laughed us out of the office. They said it's free speech. And it really did alter my life. But I'm also concerned about the way things are now in the double standards, where women are taped by their ex, you know, their boyfriends, and those tapes are put online after a breakup. And someone being interviewed gave an example of the supposedly fat and ugly woman being taped. And are these criminally prosecuted? Mm. Is this being taken more seriously because this this person who was hurt was male?
Well,
is there a double standard?
Andrew, that's a very interesting question. Danielle, do you want to take that first? And then, Suzanne,
yeah,
I'd like to hear what you have to say. Go ahead, Danielle. Go
ahead. What we're seeing, though, is unfortunately not a huge change in events. That law enforcement routinely tell, let's say if it's online harassment or on and offline stalking, to tell victims to say, look, come back to me when they confront you face-to-face or when they come to your workplace. But otherwise, just turn off your computer, watch for yourself, but come back when it gets more serious, even though criminal laws in state-to-state often criminalize online harassment, offline stalking, and right? So that this problem of the under-enforcement law persists and, frankly, has not gotten much better, both having to do with sort of hybrid stalking online and offline, but also offline stalking, that there's a lack of education for law enforcement. They don't know what to do when they see it. And in many cases, just say, look, boys, we'll be boys. Just turn off your computer. Or there's nothing we can do about it, even though, as it turns out, law absolutely could step in.
Well, and Andrea described, obviously, a very frightening situation being stalked. This was back in the 1980s. Suzanne Goldberg, you want to add anything to that? And Andrea, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Suzanne?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that, you know, anybody who is the victim of one of these crimes faces huge hurdles, because sometimes, as horrible as it is to experience the photo or the video on the internet, the experience of trying to have it prosecuted can be worse, and the more efficient way to deal with this sometimes is to contact the sort of online places that try to, reputation kinds of protectors that try to take these things offline. The other question, though, about those kinds of postings that's interesting is, well, do they fit under the bias crime statute? Now, invasion of privacy to put a video of somebody either without clothing or engaged in sex without that person's consent to put that online would seem to me to fit under the invasion of privacy statute. Whether it's in addition a bias intimidation crime, I think depends again on the context. Was the person posting intending to target the woman in the scenario that Danielle mentioned because she's a woman, or because they had a bad breakup and this is sort of personalized vengeance? I mean, there's, you know, these things are not, they don't fall out into neat boxes, but that's the sort of question that one would want to ask about a situation like that.
Well, both of you teach at universities, and we're talking about this Rutgers University case. And Danielle, what advice would you have for universities related to what we've been talking about in this hour?
Right. I think the universities have such an important responsibility to educate, to, if there's something that happens on campus, to get in there, to talk about it, to help their students see, to not just be bystanders, to report to an online service provider if there is something that's quite troubling, like a picture of someone who's naked next to, let's say, racial slurs. Universities have an important role here, right? If they don't, we're going to institutionalize a lot of the, you know, terrible bigotry that we're seeing. And these are opportunities to educate people, and I think we've got to start certainly much earlier than universities. You've got to start in lower schools and talk about how to be a responsible digital citizen.
I hear you. Suzanne, you're at Columbia University. In fact, director of the University Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. Are universities, since we've been focusing on universities in this hour, are they doing enough? Have they done enough to educate their student body?
I don't think so. And just to reinforce what Danielle just said, I think there are three keys, right? One, make clear rules, to let the students know about the rules in ways that the students absorb them, which is not through a generic email the first week of classes, right? It's through an ongoing set of meetings where students have to engage about the meaning of the rule, the applications of the rules, do role-playing around the rules. And then the third is have meaningful enforcement, because what we see often is that universities might have a great set of rules in place, but when push comes to shove and these kind of actions happen, the victim is either turned away or somehow strongly encouraged not to press charges under the rules because it might have negative consequences for his or her academic experience. And I guess the last piece is to provide more support for the victim so that they're not re-victimized in the process of trying to have the rules enforced.
And Danielle, final question here, but do you think cases like this can make for a good or bad law?
Well, let's hold our judgment, I think, until the sentence. I think for the reasons that we were initially worried about, it could be bad law, right? Because what it can do is discourage all the things that we've been talking about that we ought to take seriously, concerns about, you know, harassment and privacy invasions and stalking, where we really see bigotry, and so that we already see so much under enforcement of the law. My hope is that we don't see more as a result of a bad sentencing.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Daniel Citron, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And Suzanne Goldberg, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And she's Suzanne Goldberg, clinical professor of law at Columbia University, director of the university's Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. Daniel Citron, professor of law at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law, working on a book to be called Hate 3.0, to be published by Harvard University Press, talking more about or writing more about this whole issue of privacy, civil rights, and cyber law. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. And you can certainly join our Facebook conversation talking about this Rutgers spy cam case. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.